Well, in the last book of his fantasy series, The Chronicles of Narnia, y'all know that? C.S. Lewis describes a passage, a bridging from one reality to another, from an old and somewhat faded world of Narnia to a new one that's richer and more vivid. Here's what he writes. The new one was a deeper country. Every rock and flower and blade of grass looked as if it meant more. I can't describe it any better than that. If you ever get there, you will know what I mean. It was the unicorn who summed up what everyone was feeling. He stamped his right forehoof on the ground and neighed and then cried, "I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I've been looking for all my life, though I never knew it till now. The reason why we love the old Narnia is that it sometimes looked a little like this. Whee! Come further up. Come further in." He shook his mane and sprang forward into a great gallop, a unicorn's gallop, which in our world would have carried him, which would have carried him out of sight in a few moments. But now a most strange thing happened. Everyone else began to run, and they found, to their astonishment, that they could keep up with him. The air flew in their faces as if they were driving fast in a car without a windscreen. You know it's British, right? The country flew past as if they were seeing it from the windows of an express train. Faster and faster they raced, but no one got hot or tired or out of breath. So they ran faster and faster till it was more like flying than running, and even the eagle overhead was going no faster than they. And they went through winding valley after winding valley and up the steep sides of hills and faster than ever down the other side, following the river and sometimes crossing it and skimming across mountain lakes as if they were living speedboats, till at last at the far end of one long lake which looked as blue as turquoise, they saw a smooth green hill. Its sides were as steep as the sides of a pyramid, and round the very top of it ran a green wall. But above the wall rose the branches of trees, whose leaves looked like silver and their fruit like gold. "Further up and further in," roared the unicorn, and no one held back. Well, let's go further up and further in together on this bridging day. But let's start by singing, and please don't hold back. Hymn number 128, "For All That Is Our Life." Thanks. That is such a sweet hymn. Faster and faster they raced, but no one got hot or tired or out of breath. So they ran faster and faster till it was more like flying than running, and even the eagle overhead was going no faster than they. "Further up and further in," roared the unicorn, and no one held back. Lewis gives us a wonderful description of a group of friends, a community, you could say, sharing this sense of astounding physical vigor. You can almost feel the rush of wind in their ears. There they go, full speed ahead into an amazing new life, more vivid than anything they've known before. The only problem is that when you probe further into the story, you discover that all of the human characters are dead. Or I should say that their bodies have died. All of them at once in a sudden train wreck. But for C.S. Lewis, they are alive in Christ, and so more alive than ever, in a spiritual mirror world more real than our physical bodily one. Some readers have felt cheated or betrayed by passages like this. They say that he shouldn't have pushed such stuff on children, using stories of lions and witches and unicorns to push what's really about death and crosses. Lewis had had an experience of religious conversion to a new life that was almost as vivid for him as the new Narnia is for his characters. That conversion came, by the way, in a night-long conversation with J.R.R. Tolkien, another fantasy writer. But a completely new life, a new bodily life, filled with renewed spirit, had to mean undergoing a resurrection like that of Jesus. In order to experience it fully, your body must die as your Savior's did for you. This fits well with the author's New Testament experience. No doubt, it's a comfort for many. But there's a very different view in the older part of what so many call the good book, the Bible. You can find it in places like the book of Isaiah, chapter 40, which starts, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God," meaning a comfort that is both spiritual and bodily. A voice cries, "In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for your God. Every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain and hill made low. The uneven ground shall become level, the rough places a plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together." A voice says, "Cry." Now the Hebrew word here means a singing out, a cry, where you put your body behind your voice. Voice says, "Cry." And I said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people's is grass." King James. "The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever." We feel the bumps and kinks and angles of the world relax, as if its tension has been soothed away. Valleys are lifted, mountains made low, broken ground smooths over, and flesh is like grass. You see how breath and word come together here. How could it be otherwise? How could it be otherwise? A word is a sounding breath, tongue and tooth and palate, an embodied covenant of meaning. We can put it on the page, but we can only know it in the body. Hear how the word makes the body alert. "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint. And to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary. Young men shall fall exhausted, but they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." You get energized by reconnecting to the source that Isaiah calls God. But Isaiah does not say that anyone has to die first in order to experience such renewal. Our waiting will energize us if we relax vigilantly. Relax vigilantly. And it happens in this life, on real hills and grass and mountains, not after death or up in the sky. You may remember these lines of Isaiah's from the movie Chariots of Fire, where the runner Eric Little hears them in a sermon right before his 1924 Olympic races. Remember Chariots of Fire? It got a little overused, but it can come back now. We also hear him say, "I believe that God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure." For someone like him, comfort, comfort my people means the whole person, body and soul. Of course, some religious folks are not comfortable with comfort. We were all, I think, uncomfortable to learn that throughout Mother Teresa's years of missionary work to comfort the poorest of the poor, she wore a cilice. It's a device like a barbed wire garter, tightened daily for high-level spiritual discipline as it produces constant low-level pain. The original Mother Teresa, though, St. Teresa of Avila, Mother Superior, founder of several convents in 16th century Spain, followed certain austerities herself and suffered a number of illnesses, but always found physical comfort in her spiritual visions. When some suggested the devil might have inspired these, it was the body after all, she replied, Like imperfect sleep, which instead of giving more strength to the head, doth but leave it the more exhausted, the result of mere operations of the imagination is but to weaken the soul. Instead of nourishment and energy, she reaps only lassitude and disgust, whereas a genuine heavenly vision yields to her a harvest of spiritual riches and an admirable renewal of bodily strength. In other words, her religious experience has been good for her body, not after her death, but during her real life on this planet. And it showed. It showed. Good for Saint Teresa. Now, how about for you? Is your religion good for your body? Even if it's a religion that you kind of made up yourself? Is it good for your body right here, right now? Is it good for your body over the long run, like for the athlete who said, "When I run, I feel his pleasure"? Is it too much to ask your religion for some bodily comfort or even for some pleasure? When we talk about any religion, we often start with its words. Are those words good to the body? Do they speak well of our flesh and bone? Are its teachings kind, loving, and respectful to us as embodied creatures? Do they celebrate the body or treat it as a problem to be overcome? I was attracted to Hinduism when I was young. At first, through the beauty of Indian music, which seemed at once so erotic and so devout. Mixes loving and praying. Oh yeah. We had some joking about that at the Hogan's barbecue last night. Loving and praying. Nice combination. And Hindu temple art also looked so different to me from what's found in Christian settings. Naked or near naked bodies can be seen in both, but in Christian churches, they're usually being punished or tortured or martyred in full color stained glass vividness. In India, they might be seated calmly in yoga postures, or dancing with vigor, or even wrapped together in an athletic sexual embrace. Surely, this must be a religion that celebrates the body. And surely it does, in some ways. But let's be careful before leaping athletically to any hasty conclusions. Hindu myths tell of a huge cosmic person who was sacrificed and cut into pieces by the gods. The priestly caste rose from his head, warriors from his chest and shoulders, merchants from the belly, and laborers from the feet. So the closer to the head your people come from, the better the stuff you are made of. And this helps to determine your caste. Those called untouchables are thought not to come from this cosmic person at all, but rather from the dirt beneath his feet. So they're only fit to do the dirtiest jobs, clean toilets, haul away animal carcasses, stuff like that. It's not that they get dirty from their work. They're born that way. So dirt is their natural element. Caste is social, but it's also a very bodily affair. So is Hinduism, or one of the other religions of the East, better for your body than the religions of the West? The best answer may be yes and no. It depends on where and how you look. Your religion may offer you some comfort and joy, but is it also good for the bodies of those around you? Does it make victims, slaves, targets, or prisoners of people who have different skin colors or sexual preferences? Is your religion good for your neighbor's bodies as well as for your own? And what about our own religious movement? We can find some very promising words in the statement of principles that's on the back of your order of services. The first principle celebrates the inherent worth and dignity of every person without regard to status, achievement, or judgments that were made from clean or dirty stuff. Worth and dignity come along with a human body. That's a pretty good start. The last principle speaks of respect for the interdependent web of existence, meaning a web like that produced by a spider's body. It's the only image in all of our principles, sources, etc. The only concrete image. It's a physical connection, not only spiritual. Every year since 1961, the UUA issues statements of public witness on pressing social issues, and almost every one of those, if you look back, connects to the human body. Many statements from the 70s center on women's rights, while those from the 60s emphasize those of African Americans. Now, when I mention caste and one Hindu view of the human social body, I trust that no one thought, there's nothing like that here. What was the basis for the notion that black people were only good for slavery and women for childbearing and rearing, if not a bodily one? A judgment that such bodies come with more limited minds and souls than white male ones do. We have made statements supporting abortion rights and the well-being of the aged, statements of solidarity with bisexual, gay, and transgendered people, statements against tobacco price supports in order to discourage smoking, statements advocating child care or opposing corporal punishment, reform of drug laws, pushing for home health care, hospices, good nutrition for a healthy start in life, and the right to die when one is ready with no one holding you back. What's the common feature? It's the body, 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 over and over again. That's the main concern. We just don't say it explicitly. Not yet. The poet Walt Whitman, while not a member of any church, was closely identified with the transcendentalist movement that was full of Unitarian and Universalist women and men. His most famous poem begins, that song of myself. I celebrate myself and I sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. He's not just talking to report his thoughts. He sings. He puts his body behind it. I am the poet of the body, and I am the poet of the soul. The pleasures of heaven are with me, and the pains of hell are with me. The first I graft and increase upon myself. The latter I translate into a new tongue. I am the poet of the woman, the same as the man. And I say it is as great to be a woman as to be a man. And I say there is nothing greater than the mother of men. That was pretty strong for the 19th century. But what comes next is even strong for today. I have said that the soul is not more than the body. And I have said that the body is not more than the soul. And nothing, not God, is greater to oneself, to one than oneself is. And whoever walks a furlong without sympathy walks to his own funeral dressed in his shroud. God is not greater to you than yourself, whatever you may have heard or said to the contrary. But indifference to your neighbor's joy or pain is death in life. Be awake to yourself and to others, body and soul. By all reports, Whitman moved as vigorously as he wrote, striding through his own real country with enormous physical energy. Maybe he never joined one of our churches in his time, but I hope that our church can join him now. Maybe we can join Whitman with a new principle that affirms the body in no uncertain terms. It might read something like this: We covenant to affirm and promote our understanding that the body is good, no less than the soul, and that we owe good care to both. It's just a draft. But we need to be careful of making the body just something more to talk about. We really need to be careful about that kind of thing. More to talk about, even if we do so with energy and eloquence. We need more than talk. Maybe we need a t-shirt. Excuse me. Maybe one like this. It says, dance, don't trudge. Sing, don't mutter. Breathe like you enjoy it. Lift, don't weigh the whole thing down. And then on the back, relax vigilantly. If I'm remembered for two words, I'd like it to be those two. These are the rules that I'd hoped to share at our recent interfaith potluck before my body was laid low by the flu, where our table talk was about what commandments we live or try to live by. I was at a loss when I first started to ponder that question. I thought of talking about affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of every person, but that seemed too abstract for dinner conversation. I wanted something that was more step by step, bite by bite, like food itself, like life. And this is what came to me. It's 5 points, not 10 commandments, just a handful. So maybe it's easier to remember. You like my shirt? You want one? Might have to work on the design a bit. It's just a draft. I'm not proposing that everyone at CUC should wear one. But wouldn't you love to hear people say, isn't that the church where people seem to have a special glow? Even those who move by aid of cane, wheelchair, or walker do it like they love it. Body and soul. They look like they're happy to be here in this world, even when they're walking to a funeral, or wheeling there, or pogoing along with a cane. They look so eager for life. I'd sure love to hear folks say that. Maybe the t-shirt should include our tumbleweed chalice and CUUC, Physical Education Department. Should we have a PE department? Maybe Christy will help us start one when she's done with her yoga teaching certification. No principle, and certainly no t-shirt, can guarantee that we will always run and not be weary, run and never faint. But if one can help take us up further, if a t-shirt can help take us further up and further in, I think it's done its job. I think a principle has done its job. Long before our journey's end, I hope that we all can say, I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I've been looking for all my life, though I never knew it till now. So may it be.